kids. It's time to get some SML podcast all up in that.
What's up, everyone? This is the SML Podcast. I am your host, Joe. We are back to work, back at it, and we got a bunch of reviews we got to take care of because games kept coming out while we were away. Starting things off like we usually do, Pernell Vaughn, you're here. How are you?
I'm doing okay, though. Like you said, the game train just kept rolling. As I think, again, I think we've lost that period where breaks actually occurred. They just don't.
Yeah, so, we had like a week of no games, and then it's just more shit coming. Last episode, we had two reviews. Two. That was nice. That was relaxing. This one, we've got nine coming.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
There it is. The party's up.
Break time's over. Back to work, motherfuckers.
Quack, quack, quack. But it's not work. It's fun work.
How was your MAGFest?
Mag was pretty solid, though I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to staff again because apparently I didn't put enough hours like I was supposed to. But in my defense, I was there for 2 days, and of those 2 days, each day I was there for like 8 hours. And of the 8 hours, they wanted me to work six. I was like, no, I can't do 6 hours out of eight. So I worked 4 hours here and then still ended up rolling into like 6 to 7 hours, depending, because like if my ride was staying a little longer, I would hang out a little longer at my staff booth before going and doing something else. So I was 4 hours short of what they wanted me to put in. I'm like, well, I was only there Friday, Saturday, and not even for the full day. But I put in those Pokemon battles, damn it. So, but all in all, it was fun. I got to see some friends. I played some games. I got my Poppin' Fix in. Even walked around the indie booth a little bit and looked around.
We got to share some Nando's.
Damn right. Nando's is amazing.
And God damn right it is.
Thing about it is, like, if I can learn how to cook my chicken like they do, I'd be baller, because I think I told you that, but you can buy their sauces at the store.
Though, yeah, you were saying.
I will admit, though, for the price you pay for the sauce and the amount they get and the amount that I put on when I go to the restaurant, I'm probably beating them over the head financially just for that. Because I dunked my chicken in the extra hot Nando sauce. No regrets. None. But there is one place up here. I should have just smuggled some Nando's up here for the comparison, but there's a place that opened up here called Pyrie's. And Pyrie's is another Perry Perry type restaurant. There's only two in the United States, Delaware and Florida.
Interesting.
And apparently, I mean, like, I went there, food's pretty damn good. It feels like it's a carbon copy of Nando's, which leads me to believe that Nando's thing isn't so much a special recipe that they have. It's just a style of food, and the stuff that they make is based on that style. And Pyrie's is the exact same style, which means their sauce concoctions are fairly similar. But not that I'm complaining, because it's still freaking bangers. I just wonder which one is the superior Perry Perry. One or the other. I don't know.
I'll go with Nando's, just because I've been there.
I can't fault you for that. But I am genuinely curious, and one day I'm going to find out. Though, like I said, the first step is either to smuggle some Nando's up north, or to learn how to cook my chicken like they cook theirs, buy the sauce at the grocery store and just drizzle it up and then compare it directly to Pyrie's.
Yeah, if you ever come visit me, I'm going to make you stop by Nando's and pick me up a Caesar salad on your way up.
Is there a Nando's on the way to you?
No, you would have to go to the one there.
Oh, I go to National Harbor, Purnell, and then drive up here.
Yeah, man. I'll throw you gas money.
I'd be a lot of gas money. And time money, because that's time. Though, admittedly, the Pyrie's would be another story, because, again, that's like down the road from me. It's Nando's. It's the crazy drug.
Bucket, I'll try Pyrie's then.
Oh, but the go back to the thing I mentioned to you earlier. We were talking earlier about how insanely popular Smash Brothers is, and how I know people who love to complain about people who won't stop talking about Smash Brothers. They want to hear people talk about the games that they like, and then my response is typically, well, Smash Bros. Makes money, and when the game you want makes the kind of money Smash is making, people will talk about it, too. And the follow-up was, I love Magical Drop 3. You know, by talking about Magical Drop 3, Magical Drop 3 ain't making money. But
Smash is.
but Smash is. And it got me, it made me think of an idea for an interesting thing that can be revived these days, but probably won't. There was an old online game called Puzzle Pirates that a friend and I used to play. And it was basically a game where you were a pirate and you would sail across the land with your friends, all working together to man a ship, kind of like how that the Xbox One game, what's it called, like Sea of Thieves?
Yeah.
If you kind of like that, how everybody worked together to manipulate the ship. And then you go to islands and find stuff, and then sometimes you get like pirate battles. But the gimmick was that every aspect of the game was a puzzle game. So if you were sailing the ship, there was like this weird like orb matching game, and depending on how well you did, determine how fast the ship went. Sword of combat was like Tetris Attack. And there was just like a bunch of just different puzzle-esque games that determined how things got done. And when you found equipment and set it up, it augmented your stats for the various puzzle games. Now imagine if someone took that, gussied it up for modern-day consoles, and then, heaven forbid, even got a bunch of licensed puzzle games and slammed them all in there en masse. So like sailing could be Tetris, and sword fighting could still be Tetris Attack. And let me see, like maybe like digging for gold could be like Puyo Puyo. Just weird. Oh, sorry, Mr. Driller.
Oh, there you go.
And you can just have games like that all integrated into this overall mess. It would be, I'd play the hell out of it. I would pay a subscription fee to play that game. I don't know how many other people would, but they should, because it sounds like gold. That's liquid gold.
I have clearly missed out by never playing Puzzle Pirates.
It might still be available. When this episode is over, you should look it up on the internet, see if it's still there. But I bet it is.
I'll have to give it a look.
Puzzle Pirates, yo ho ho. I'll have
to check a look.
Take a look.
Oh, man. Speaking of games, we got some games to talk about. Should we dive into these?
Let's yammer yammer.
All right. First game to talk about on this episode is called Yik, or Y2K, a postmodern RPG developed by Axe Studios, published by Easebrood Games, released January 17th on the Switch, PC, and PS4 for $19.99. I don't see Xbox on there. Damn it.
maybe later. Cross fingers.
My fingers are always crossed for more RPGs on Xbox. Anyway, in this surreal Japanese-style RPG, when a mystery woman vanishes from an elevator in front of his eyes, fresh graduate Alex assembles a squad of internet misfits to investigate her disappearance. Tackle turn-based battles with a novel blend of twitchy minigames, weird weapons, and weirder enemies. Pernell, tell us about it.
So, this game is such a mixed bag for me, because just like how last year when I came back on, one of the first games I got to review was Iconoclast, which was a huge game I was anticipating. This is another game like that that I was hugely anticipating for a number of years, and I was fortunate enough to get to review it. And it's weird, because while I definitely found myself enjoying the game for the most part, there were definitely a few things I feel are worth mentioning that may be like a if or whatnot for other players, but I'll get into that. So, the idea of the game is, like you said, it starts out with Alex coming home from school and experiencing a series of weird events resulting in someone that he just met disappearing in a weird way from an elevator. And the game ends up being a matter of him exploring along with people that he's meeting along the way to try to figure out what the heck happened to this mystery woman and hopefully to rescue her or find her or whatever. Now, this game, if you've watched any of the trailers from this game, is pretty freaking obvious that there was a huge Earthbound inspired vibe to it. And I'm pretty sure that the maker of it was not intending to hide that fact. So this is not a rip. It's an homage. Let's nail that down. and it's honestly, I like as far as like the aesthetics and stuff go, I feel as though they did do a good job of doing that game service, because it's a modern style RPG, but it's got that level of quirky dialogue that Earthbound had. It did a good job with how Earthbound would do various music tracks during the battles. Like, it had a multitude of music. This game is like that too. And the vast majority of the music in the battles is really nice. And it has a number of pretty acclaimed, like, almost the acclaimed, because it's not like, actually it does have some acclaims. I think it has like the guy from Secret of Mana that did a few tracks for this game.
Oh, damn.
But there's a number of acclaimed composers in this game, and the music shows. In the battles, while they're not Earthbound style, but they still also take a lot of inspiration from other games. So, for example, the main character, Alex, his battle method is a turntable drops on the screen, and you have to hit the X button in time to when colored sections of the record come across the needle. And that most likely resembles something out of Shadow Hearts, which was a game on the old PlayStation 2, where it was a dial that you had to hit the X button on when the dial went over color sections of the dial. And every character has their own unique way of doing combat. What usually involving like timed button presses, or like holding down the thumbstick to kind of do like a flick motion, and so on and so forth. I don't find those to be a problem. I actually enjoy having the action options in combat because it keeps you on your toes instead of just kind of passing out and hitting X. However, one thing that bugged me about it is that, I mean, maybe it was just me, but combat can take a while because normal attacks never really seemed like they did as much damage as I would have liked to kind of mow through the mobs. But on the positive, mobs are static. They don't come back in dungeons. When you're in a dungeon and you fight and you walk across the enemy that's kind of walking around the screen and you do combat with him, he's dead and he's gone for good. So no worrying about being stuck in dungeons, just fighting guys and grinding because you're not allowed to.
That's but cool.
It's honestly nice. I like that a lot because even if I found myself going, oh man, these battles are taking way too long, I want to get this dungeon over with, I did at least know that it was a finite number of enemies to deal with, and when they were done, they were freaking done. Story-wise, and I feel like I'm jumping around a lot because I'm just like, I like talking about this game. Story-wise, you're going to get a mixed bag from the story. I've heard a number of people refer to this game as like Soybound, which is kind of funny, but at the same time also kind of, yeah. But I feel as though there was some aspects to that that weren't far off though. The main character, for those who like to use the nomenclature, most definitely comes off as a hipster type, and he has his moments in the game where he runs off with a bit of rambling, and it's just like, you know, like, I was confused and worried, like a man running down the stairs with his pants falling down his ankles. He didn't know where he was going, but he was getting there fast, or some weird lines like that, and you just find yourself going, why? I don't want to hear these. I don't want to hear any of this. I just want the story to progress. I don't need your inner monologues to run, which in some games, I guess, wouldn't be such a big deal, but I just kind of didn't like a lot of his inner monologues that he would speak to the player. And the best way I could think of it is maybe this is what I've dubbed the Tidus effect in RPGs, where, are you familiar with Final Fantasy X?
Yeah.
But sigh, the main character, Tidus, in that game, whenever I generally ask around, people don't like him very much. They call him a whiny, sissy man who needs to pull his pants up and get down to business. And my retort to that has always been that I wasn't a big fan of Tidus either, but I'm fairly positive he was written that way intentionally because it had to show the character for what he was and who he became by the end of the game. He had to start out as a whiny type of guy, so as experiences could ultimately change him into a better person. And I feel like that kind of happens with Alex in this game too, though admittedly his annoying monologues do continue to occur. He does sort of become a better person as the game progresses because he grows along with the people he meets and the experiences that he takes on. So yeah, he's a kind of annoying putz, but I think he's meant to be that way. In the sense that that was how his story is meant to be run, be told. It's not just like, hey, I just can't write a character. It's more like, I wanted him to be this way, and I intended for him to sound this way. So
for that redemption later in the story.
Exactly, exactly. So worth pointing that out. I honestly like his friends that he meets, too. They're all generally very different characters with their different bits of personalities, and they all kind of have a nice little interaction that goes throughout the game, though. One thing that I did find kind of funny is that as you're walking around, like you'll go onto the world map or whatever to go to like a location, you'll get into a battle with a giant bouncing smiley face, and you beat the smiley face up, or you might fight an alien in a UFO. You beat the alien in a UFO, no big deal, just moving on. And then you go to this weird factory, which this is no spoiler, this is the very beginning of the game. So you go to a factory, and there's like poison on the ground, and like weird animals, no big deal, beat them up too with a record in your hand. And then suddenly, later on, a story-scripted weird thing happens, and your guy goes, oh my god, what's going on? I'm like, wait, what? This is the thing. This is the thing that made you stop and note that weird shit's going on. All that other stuff was just normal, though, apparently. Giant heads on springs is normal in your world.
Of course it is.
It's just a very normal thing. I don't know. But that was just a random thing that I kind of found funny because that sort of thing happens a lot in the game. There's even a point later where, without spoiling exactly what it is, you see a very, what would I would think would be very standout scene for the main character. Like, he would see it and go, holy shit, what is this? Why is this here? But he makes no comment about it at all. And I just kind of stood in the area for a minute. I was like, why aren't you saying anything? I mean, this is kind of what the point of the game is, and you're just ignoring it. Whatever. I don't know. So I was like, just weird moments where I feel like, hey, there should be a little bit more indication of this is weird in this world, or this is weird in this situation. Why aren't you exclaiming it? Or why aren't you talking about it? But small thing there. Let me think what I was going to say. The environment and the atmosphere. One thing I will say that they did nail down pretty freaking well, like in a nerdy way. There's a website that you go to on occasion called Onism 1999. It is designed to look like a Netscape Navigator classic website, like an old forum. And when you go to your computer, it does all the old modem boot up sounds, and you go to the website and you click on the image and it goes to like just like a bunch of different, like, you know, topics you can click on, and like a bunch of dialogue has occurred in them. You can read through them. And whoever sat down and wrote those forum posts, they were clearly either alive back in the 90s or they studied up, because the flow of them is pretty accurate. The snark is accurate. It's like, it's just the right amount of snark in the replies and posts. I mean, like, 2018 internet snark is nothing compared to 90s internet snark, because I guess this is me being a hipster in my own way, but back then you had a lot less people getting on the internet. So it was almost like a more curated type of person talking on the forums then, versus now it's like, literally anybody could just be like, hey, you're a loser, whatever, I love politics. And back then it was like, well, you have a pretty curated group of guys. They're like internet aficionados. This is what they're here for. They know what they're doing, and their dialogue kind of shows it. But I feel as though he nailed that sort of those exchanges pretty well. There's people, I've read some of them, the replies on the made-up forums there, and just kind of cringed, and then was like, I used to cringe in the 90s too.
Oh God.
So weird. Like, but it works in that way. The game itself, like I said, it's a fairly lengthy game. Like, it's not a short game, though. It's hard to say whether or not the game is lengthy because of the game itself or because of the, I guess I didn't mention it before, but because of the fact that I feel like the battles can take a while, because I never feel like I'm doing enough damage to enemies.
Yeah,
I'm
you doing mentioned that.
Yeah, good. Thank you. I feel like the game may take longer on account of that aspect, which I guess admittedly can be alleviated by using more special attacks, which I guess takes me to another interesting point about the game, which is that this is strange, but I think you pretty much get all of your skills pretty early on, unless something weird is being missed. And the reason why I'm saying that is because I got a trophy around like level 25. And the game was like, you earned every skill from the mine dungeon. And I was like, what the hell are you talking about? There's no way I have every skill in the game so far. But the game claimed I did. And I didn't come across any new ones since then, aside from like if a new party membership, they came with their own skills. But that's a weird thing worth mentioning in of itself. That's one other thing I wanted to mention, speaking of which. Oh, leveling up in this game. So leveling up is done in a very strange way. And I have one more thing to mention after this, too. I got to mention. But leveling up is strange in this game. So the way they have you do it is there's a thing called the Mind Dungeon. And the way that works is your main character picks up a telephone and places a phone call to his brain. He goes inside of it, and he goes down a series of floors, like a sort of 2D dungeon and each floor has like four doors on it. And each door has a stat on top of it, like a numeric amount, like 1 or 2 or 1.5. You go up to the door, and you say what stat you want that to be allocated towards, and then you walk into the door to acquire the stat itself. And once you've unlocked all and entered all four doors that are on a floor, you then have to go up to the exit of the floor, pay 100 experience points to go onto the next floor. It seemed pretty creative and cool in and of itself when I first started doing it. But the problem was it became kind of tedious eventually, and it takes a while. You start to feel like it takes a while because you have to hit the button, The game will ask you to tell it what stat you want to allocate the stat points to. Then you have to select it. Then you have to click the button again on the door. Then say enter the door. And then the game will say you found an icon. And it'll tell you how much it was for. And then it has to step back out. And then it has to close the door. And then you can do that 3 more times. It damn. Gets old, and they should speed that up. Speed it up, man. Admittedly, there is an option where you can just walk up to the exit immediately, and the game, you can tell the game to allocate the stats automatically, which is a lot faster and better for your time, but then you're not customizing it. You're letting the game customize it, so it takes something away, in fact, in response to just giving you, in exchange for giving you more time.
Yeah.
You know, before is where I said, hey, just allocate them, because I don't feel like dealing with this right now. Just do the dump for me. So if the developer is listening, please patch the game so that that dialogue can go faster. Because I think if that happens, it wouldn't be nearly as big of a deal. Because I didn't mind going up to the different rooms and allocating. It's just the time it takes to do it all.
And if the developer's listening, patch it when you release it on Xbox.
Bam! And the last but probably most important thing, depending on who you are anyway, is the story itself. I'm not going to go and say that the story is bad, because I don't think it is. I think it's an interesting way that it's being told, and I like seeing the characters interact and go on their adventure. But what I will say is that for the subject matter that's being conveyed, it's told in a way that makes it feel rather confusing. Maybe a smarter person than me won't have this problem. I'm not saying I'm dumb, but I know I'm not a genius either. But to just kind of lay out a general vibe without spoiling the game as a whole, one of the main story cruxes in the game is a weird phenomenon where a person's soul can leave their body and go to a place in between universes called a soul space. And it flies around there and maybe can come back, but otherwise it could go to another reality where another you lives, and your soul can take that body. Only if that soul left its body to go to the soul space. It does this like weird roundabout way of saying how that works and like what factors into it and what characters are influenced by it and blah, blah, blah. And I feel like this is one of those things where, like, for as weird and bizarre as the concept is, if it was told and explained in a specific way, it wouldn't be confusing at all. Because honestly, we've played Persona, we've played Mega 10 games, we've played Tales games. We've played all kinds of games that have very bizarre stories that involve parallel universes, soul body swapping, and all that crazy shit. That's not foreign. But for some reason, the way it was explained in this game, it was a little tougher for me to click with and go, okay, now I understand what's going on. Now I feel like I'm going with it. So a lot of the game was me just saying, I just want to move on and see how these kids handle all that. I want to buy a burger at the next gas station. Sounds cool to me. You know, so depending on how important you feel the story is to you, that may well influence your take on the game. Because like I said, I feel like the story itself is a weird one as far as how it's told, and it might not mesh with you, at least not for the first like block of hours or so. So, but as you get, there's like a different, obviously it's like a big story element where it's like, okay, now we're going to lay out the line. Like, here's the big deal and why everything's happening. And while it's still kind of confusing, it does make it easier to understand than it was earlier on. So maybe that'll do the trick for a player. So
maybe. But overall, $20 on this one. What do you think of it?
I honestly think it's a definite try it. And if you're okay with just experiencing it and maybe not 100% clicking with the plot, it's a buy it. But it's a definite try it at least, because I definitely enjoyed my time playing it.
Awesome. Sounds good. And hopefully they'll bring it to more platforms.
Yes, I concur. It deserves that love. I think is this one of those games where like it was like one guy that developed the whole thing?
I think it was two guys. I think it was a pair of brothers. If I'm remembering correctly, which I might not be because I'm dumb too.
Look at us, a bunch of dummy dumb dumbs.
How the hell can I tie my shoes in the morning?
With help.
Anyway, next game to talk about is called Planet Rix 13, developed by Nine Eyes Game Studio, published by Sometimes You, released January 16th on Xbox One, Switch, PS4, and Vita for $4.99. Planet Rix 13 is a classic 2D adventure with pixel art graphics that takes place on an uncharted planet. You are the pilot of a spacecraft that is looking far and exploring worlds that are potentially suitable for... Oh, sorry. You are the pilot of a spacecraft that is looking for and exploring worlds that are potentially suitable for life. If I could read, that would be a magical thing.
With a little help, you could.
The same help that helps me tie my shoes in the morning. Purnell, tell us about Planet Rix 13.
Well, I can immediately tell you that you never fly a ship. The game proper. But Planet Rix 13, oh my God. This game was, well, I'm going to outright initially start out by saying the game is functional. But
okay.
The idea behind this game is that you are trying to, you crash land on a planet and you're trying to figure out how to get off of it. And while you're trying to get off of the planet, you have to figure out what happened to the people that were there. And it, and any other circumstance, that would sound pretty exciting. However, the way this game does it is, the best way to describe it is, like, it's an adventure game boiled down to the most core of cores. As to say, you go to different locations, all of which are tiny locations, so you don't spend a lot of time in any of them. You find an item. The item can be used in another location. You go there, use it, get another item. The item can be used in another location, wash, rinse, repeat until the game is over. What that means is it starts out with you coming across your first location. And that location has, like, say, like a 3D printer, which means you can make items on the 3D printer so long as you have the schematics. So you might go to a second location, which is discovered by finding a piece of paper in the first location that says it's over here. You go to the main map, teleport to that location, find schematics to an oxygen tank. Go back to the 3D printer, print the oxygen tank. Now you have an oxygen tank, and that's used to go to the third location that's already on the map to breathe in a room, to avoid poison, to get another item that can be taken back to location one, used to get to location two. And I'm just basically bouncing back and forth, over and over again. And it's, I guess it wouldn't be such a big deal because, I mean, let's be blunt, a lot of games do that. They do have you bounce back and forth to a lot of locations solving puzzles. Except for the fact that, in addition to the fact that it feels all very linear and there's a lot of short-term back and forth, there's also no real risk or danger or sense of foreboding dread. So if you were to take another fairly recent-ish adventure 2D game like Lone Survivor, Lone Survivor is a game where you walk back and forth, you go between different room to room, crazy paranormal phenomenon occurs, monsters show up, and you're trying to do all kinds of things to stay alive, sometimes finding armor and guns and have to fight back against the monsters. And this, and that's kind of what helps keep the tension up, too, because you never know what's going on, you don't know where the end is, blah, blah, blah. But in this game, that tension doesn't exist. The most tension that you ever get is, like, every once in a while, there's a crystal that you might have to find. It's four crystals total, and each time you find one, like, it might be a weird little, like, paranormal incident that occurs. Like, okay, what do I do to get out of this and avoid dying? But if you're a trophy hunter, you're going to want to die anyway because there's a trophy associated with every death in the game. So,
oh boy.
Right in there, there's a lot of tension already going because you need to die to get the trophy. So you're like, okay, I can take my time thinking about what I need to do to get out of this room and let sweet death take me away. And then when I come back, I'll just do what I need to do it and move on with my life. And this only happens four times because there's only four crystals. And then the other deaths are in the same way. Like, you know, you get the oxygen tank to breathe in the cave. So obviously to get the trophy, you're going to let yourself suffocate to get the trophy and then go back in and do it properly. But in the end, what ends up happening is you experience this game that takes about an hour to play. It's not even very long. It took like an hour or two to beat the game. 2 hours more so from, actually an hour and a half for me because I got stuck on one thing where I was trying to get a sequence of items together. But, it's a ridiculously short game with no tension, no difficulty, no real sense of puzzling. It's just take item from here to here, then take item from here to here, then take item from here to here, over and over and over and over again until the game is over. And that's why I said earlier at the beginning that it's a functional game in the sense that it's not broken. There's nothing wrong with it. I actually even like the way it looked graphically. It's very simple, but it's clean and effective. I like the way it looked. But it's just, it doesn't bring anything succulent to the table, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, on the bright side, it is only a $5 game.
This is very true. This is very true. And that in and of itself is probably the determining factor on if a person would want it or not, because for $5, what you ultimately end up getting is a very straightforward exploration of a map to solve this puzzle and get off the island or and get off the planet. So you get what you pay for, but at the same time, as always is a case in this world, time is a thing. So it's a matter of, like, you want to put that $5 elsewhere to something that will, where your time will be more used or better used, something like that. But I will say that if you do buy this, the game works, is functional, and I didn't feel as though, like, my money would have been wasted if I bought it. It's just a matter of, I probably would have seen myself being like, hey, I'm going to take this 5 plus this 5 with 10 and get this game here. And it does, you know, this instead. So it's hard to say. So,
well, as it stands for $5, what's your official verdict?
It's going to be a combination of, I don't know, I guess a, I don't want to say deny it, because again, the game wasn't bad. It just wasn't good. So I'm going to go, fuck it, why not, for the cost, or deny it if the cost is an issue to you. But if the cost is not an issue, then you can't really go wrong with spending the $5 to experience the hour to hour and a half of game that you get out of it.
Yeah. Chances are I'll pick this one up. I like supporting Sometimes You when possible. They put out a lot of cheaper games and a lot of fun cheaper games, so I'll probably pick this one up and check it out.
I want to say there was one that they did that I reviewed recently that I thought was pretty good, wasn't it? Was it? It wasn't. I don't think it was Stay. That was someone else. But I have to look into it. But I'm almost positive I did. I reviewed another one of their games too long ago and thought was pretty solid.
Probably. We've covered a bunch of games from them. So
yeah, I think it's the best way to put it. Like, it's not like every game can't be the solid, but you know,
again, it's $5. So fuck it.
Fuck it. Why not?
That's why we have a fuck it, why not rating for something that, you know, it's cheap. So fuck it. Pick it up. Why not? I love that rating. I love when we get to use it.
That is very true. Because it's also kind of fun to say.
It is. Fuck it. Why not? Anyway, we got one final game to talk about with you. That is called Rava and the Cyclops Curse, developed by Galop, published by The Hidden Levels, released January 15th on Steam for only $2.99. Unleash your summoning powers to defeat the Cyclops Lord. Along with four unusual companions, you must journey through a dangerous land to save your mother, who suffered a terrible curse. A challenging adventure awaits. Purnell, tell us about it.
So, Rava is a game where it's a 2D side-scrolling platformer. And you are, well, the opening screen shows you as an owl in a cool robe and hat. But in the main game proper, you see the robe and hat. It's kind of like Solstice, where you don't know what the hell you are. You just know you're a wizard because you're wearing wizard duds. But the way the game itself works is it's a cool hopping, well, it's not even a bopper, more of a hopping shot game where you are moving through the stage and you have the four companions that Joe mentioned, or technically you mentioned earlier. And each of those companions provides you with a different sort of shot that has a different property. You have one friend that lets you fire two bullets at an upward arc shot. You have one that lets you fire like a sort of blue boomerang across the screen that allows you to freeze certain objects that can be broken with your yellow shot, which is your default gun. It's just meant to just break yellow blocks and kill dudes and break frozen things. You have the green guy, who's like a weird, like, floating mouth, who barfs green bombs. He's like kind of your powerhouse guy that drops like bombs on the ground, like in front of like a lob shot. And then lastly, there is, oh man, this is the weird one. So there's like an eyeball, and the sole purpose of the eyeball is to find hidden things. So the thing about this game is that it's enjoyable and it's a fair bit of fun. The only problem is, if you're going to buy this and you're going to play it, you might want to turn off your gotta get everything-ometer. Because, oh, no. Because the thing is, the little eyeball guy, his purpose is to push the button and a small, like a sort of like a, let's say like a mind detector radius thing kicks up. And if a secret is within the radius of your guy, hey, ta-da, you can pick it up. And it'll either be like a power shot booster or an extra life or some coins for points. But if you're obsessed with finding secrets, you're going to do that constantly because you need to constantly hit the button as you take each step to see there's a secret nearby. It breaks the momentum of the game in a way that I feel like they should just outright take the thing out, or at least make it a thing where you press it once and it like beeps for like a couple seconds so you can use it, keep moving, do stuff. Okay, we're off. Use it again. Keep moving, do stuff. But to have to keep mashing it, it makes you just, like I said, tiptoe through the stage to find every nook and cranny that you can find. But if you can stop yourself from wanting to do that and only doing it when the actual puzzle requires you to do it, the game is pretty cool. There's like portals that show up on the levels, and those portals are, well, occasionally let monsters free, and they'll just kind of pace back and forth and be jerks. And the way you stop them from coming out is by destroying the portal. Other times you'll find like other enemies that'll show up, such as like enemies that I'd say are akin to like Medusa heads from Castlevania. You have other, like, you have like bombing type monsters, like puzzle monsters, like vines that will require you to shoot them with the proper element shot to kill them, things of that nature. And the game is honestly pretty fun. It's no frills, as in you're not going to have to worry about crazy backtracking or worrying about, you know, did I miss the secret that's going to allow me to get to the next stage? No, it's just 1-1, 1-2, 1-3, 2-1, 2-1, 2-3, and so on and so forth until you get to the end of through stage 3 or whatever, and then the game is over. So it's not even all that long, but what you get in the game is a pretty good time. And the music itself, while not, you know, award-winning, it's catchy. I actually enjoyed what I listened to while I played the game. Each world has a track, not each stage. So you're going to hear that same boop, 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 boop track from stage 1-1, 1-2, and 1-3. But then we get the 2-1, you'll get a new track to listen to, and it is also good. And your stage 3 track is also good. So honestly, the game itself, I had a good time playing it. It's not easy, though. There are going to be some jumps that will piss you off. Some of those like Medusa head-esque monsters I mentioned earlier will fly in when you least expect it and give you grief. Sometimes the level will make you backtrack in order to solve a puzzle, and enemies will respawn because the game intended for you to go backwards. So they wanted you to have new adversaries to contend with as you were going back. So prepare for stuff like that. But all in all, I enjoyed the play, and I think it's an easy recommend for the price as well.
Well, then officially $3, what do you say?
I'd say it's a good buy.
Well, goodbye to you too, then.
No, bye. I'd say it's a buy.
Sounds good. Good stuff.
Or is it? Rava says yes.
Oh, Purnell, it is always good having you on chatting about these games. I'm sure we'll have you back on very soon because you're always busy with us. But any final words before we move on?
Just get sleep when you can get it, because I'm going to tell you something. In addition to what we were talking about earlier about MAGFest, oh my God, my sleep schedule has not been good. And I almost feel like I'm hallucinating sometimes. It's getting that kind of weird. But all in all, if you can get to sleep, get it. Because the games will be there when you wake up. But your consciousness might be a little jeopardized if you don't sleep properly. God, I feel like that was a PSA. But sometimes you need to dump them.
All right, moving on. We got Chris Taylor joining us. Chris, how are you doing, and how was your time away from the show?
Doing all right. My time away from the show was largely not going to MAGFest, but still getting sick.
Well, thank you for taking one for the team.
Yeah. Mostly I just stayed at home and played stuff, played Chasm. I really love that game.
How is it?
It's really good. I mean, holy shit. I mean, you know, they didn't give us a free copy for me to review or anything, so I can't say too much about how much I liked it. But I did sit down and play it until it was beaten, and I'm going to do it again at some point because it's somewhat roguelite, so you can accept that, you know, your whole thing saves and all that.
Nice.
Yeah. There's your quick review of Chasm.
Sounds good. So your official verdict.
I don't know. Like, yeah, buy it. It's hard for me not to recommend that one, honestly. It's basically Castlevania Symphony of the Night, but with a handsome knight instead of a dreamy vampire.
I don't know. I'm kind of partial to the dreamy vampire side of things.
Well, you know what? Then you should get Symphony of the Night on the Nintendo Switch.
Does it exist on... It does. It's not on the Switch yet, is it?
No, there are no Castlevanias. Only that Bloodstained game.
In due time, hopefully.
In due time, yeah. Yeah, no, I heard some good things about MAGFest, though. I heard the hit points were a hit.
I didn't get to see them. There's so many bands I didn't get to see. On the last episode, Big Adam was yelling at me for not having seen Lame Genie, and I still need to fix that mistake.
Well, you know what? There's only so much one can get around in that huge place.
There really is. I've only got so much time on my hands.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, I've never seen Lame Genie, so he could yell at me too if he wants.
Damn it, Chris.
Damn it, Adam.
Damn it, Big Adam.
Turning us against each other.
We will fight forever now.
No, Big Adam's a sweetheart.
He is. He's adorable, yeah. Too.
Yeah. I miss all y'alls.
We miss you, too.
We'll try for next year. I had to go to Japan, so that's my excuse.
You have priorities.
Also, not a lot of money.
I know that feeling all too well.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, we should probably talk about games, huh?
Let's do it.
All right. First game for you to talk about is called Atari Flashback Classic, developed by Code Mystics, published by Atari, released December 13th on the Switch for $39.99. The most comprehensive collection of arcade and home console classics comes to the Nintendo Switch system, packed with 150 all-time favorites, rare gems, and unique homebrew. Atari Flashback Classics is designed to take advantage of the touchscreen and Joy-Con controllers of the Nintendo Switch to bring new life to these iconic Atari games. I'm guessing you didn't play all 150 of them?
No, as of this writing, I am. I have not yet gotten that achievement. There actually are achievements in this game, and the very first one is try out all games.
Nice.
But here's the thing, though. Like, okay, so there's so it's a collection of games from Atari's, you know, early era. I suppose early would be their only era. But it specifically from the early arcades. There's 32 arcade games, and then there's a whole host of 2600 games. And then some 5200 games thrown in, which actually was kind of surprising to me. And I had never played a 5200. I have a 2600, and I have played some of these arcade games, but never had a 5200. So a lot of them would be like, you know, they had the Real Sports series. I think it's called Real Sports. I'm going to be bad at titles, so I'm actually going to hang on the title selection screen.
Well, I mean, there are 150 games to keep track of.
Yeah, so the Real Sports series. So it has, you know, baseball, basketball, boxing, soccer, tennis, all that. They include not only the 2600 version, but also the 5200 version for, like, each and every one.
Damn.
And those aren't even all the sports games. Those are just the Real Sports series games. And in fact, there's a arcade game for baseball, and there's, you know, a separate baseball game early on in the collection. And then there's, like, golf, and then, you know. So
I should probably point out that this was originally released as three volumes on Xbox and PlayStation, and this is all three of the volumes condensed into one handy package.
Exactly, yeah. And because I had considered purchasing the PS4 versions before when they started coming out, but I was like, well, let's see how many they come out with first. And then when they announced a multi-pack for the Switch, I was like, well, that's perfect. And I actually almost bought it, but I opted for something else instead. And then, like, right after that, you came at me with the review. So I was like, all right, great. Convenience.
Yay.
Yay. So, yeah. You know, so these being Atari games and such, you know, the idea here is not so much quality as quantity. So we have so much quantity that, you know, it's hard to not find something that you'll like. Of course, you know, that requires a certain patience for Atari type stuff. Or, you know, you could be like one of those people that reads like Ready Player One and like the characters in that book and film, you know, pretend that Atari is like the best thing in the world despite other things existing, but you can't legally say like, I love Atari and that other system that came out in 1985 or those other systems that came out in 1991 and, you know, anyway.
Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah, and speaking of which, that actually is something I noticed in this collection is that it's missing a lot of games that you kind of expect them to. So one of my favorite Atari arcade games is their Star Wars game, which if you've never played it, it's a three-mission vector graphic sort of first-person, you know, space shooter. where you, you know, take on the Death Star and things like that. You know, you shoot at targets, and it's all done in vector graphics, so it's really impressive and cool. And, of course, because Star Wars, they couldn't, like, throw that in here, you know?
Yeah, licensing is hard.
Yeah, licensing is tough. And so, some of the licensed stuff, or stuff that has moved on to become, you know, much bigger than the actual console, you won't find that on this particular collection. So there's no Pac-Man, there's sadly, and I thought they might have been able to get away with this, there's no Donkey Kong from Atari or from the 2600, which, or 5200, I think it came out on that too. So, you know, they're adequate substitutions, of course. As you know, there's many games that act like Pac-Man that were on the 2600, and this one features a couple of them. And it also has, you know, of course, it has the major ones that everybody knows, like, you know, Asteroids and Millipede and Pong. Pong is on here.
Nice.
In case you want to play Pong on your Nintendo Switch.
Why not?
Why not? And, yeah, like, they say... Yeah, they say that there's, like, online multiplayer on this thing as well, but I didn't get a chance to try it, but I think that's wild. Apparently, you can play Pong with people on the internet. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of awesome. One feature also that I like about the Nintendo version is that some of the games actually... Well, most of them feature some degree of touchscreen compatibility, but some are straight up, like, you can play them with the touchscreen. Oftentimes the only thing you can really do with the touchscreen is just push the one player or two player button, or access the menu. But, you know, especially in 5200 mode, that's really handy because it actually took me a little while to figure out the menu system and, with the sticks. Turns out it's the right stick. You have to use the right stick to scroll through the menu and stuff. But yeah, like you can use your thumb for that. And, so the thing I was totally planning on complaining about is the way that this collection translates the paddleball games into the new controllers. So if you're using, let's say, a pro controller, and so you have a stick and you also have a D-pad, and you want to play Breakout, well, you can play Breakout by moving the paddle to the left and right with the stick, but the sensitivity, no matter where you set the sensitivity, there's a 1-5 option that you can set on your input sensitivity. But even with it as least sensitive as possible, that stick like is super sensitive. It like throws it all the way to the left, like if you barely touch it. And on the D-pad, it literally just clicks it over to the extreme left, to the extreme right, or, you know, with no presses, it just goes to the middle. Mm. So I'm like, I don't even understand how that is. So I take out the system, put it in handheld mode, and started a game of Breakout. And not only is it in vertical mode, which is really great, because, you know, that really makes the screen fill up, but you can just move the paddleball with your hand, with your finger, and it works perfectly.
Nice.
So that's a I'm not sure how the Xbox and PS4 versions got around that, but you know, the
Switch.
It took
a lot of practice with the analog stick.
Yes. Well, never fear, because on the Switch, at least in portable mode, which, you know, you might as well. This is an Atari game. What do you need the big screen for this for?
Yeah.
I mean, apart from multiplayer. But anyways, yeah, you just move it with your finger, and it's actually really great.
Nice.
So I was I retract the complaint that I almost made. Like, it's still not great with the stick, and I wish they would, you know, make it really not sensitive. Like, you know, all the other console versions of Breakout, which are, you know, multitudinous, have it figured out. So, yeah, they could adjust something on there, I'm sure. No. But anyway, yeah, and then another thing, you know, so there's, you know, somewhat of a lack of, like, certain games that I wanted to check out. And, you know, some games, you know, 150 titles, there's still five, like, I think five of them are Breakout in some way. Oh, so, God. And, you know, with the glut of sports titles, it's not exactly, like, 150 titles that you're just going to sit there and want to, like, play each one for hours, you know?
Yeah.
This is more like you're going to want to play, like, 100 of them an hour.
Which still isn't bad when you consider
how much is on there. That's how I play Atari. So, but then the things that they did include is a little unusual. Like, there's a game on here called Basic Math. If you want to think about that for a second, it is, it's simple arithmetic. You can set it to add, subtract, multiply, or divide. And then you just set the one number with the little switches, and then it just randomly pops in other numbers and you just compute. Huh. So think about this. Who needs that nowadays? Who's going to sit their kid in front of a Nintendo Switch and be like, all right, now you're going to play an Atari emulator and learn basic math right now? There is no soundtrack and the graphics are grim. Why is there basic math in the Atari Flashbacks collection? I mean, I don't mean to pick on it, but it's just like, those of us who are old enough to know or appreciate what this is know how to do basic math. And yeah, anyway. It has a blackjack game on it though, which is kind of great. And then there's a couple of games that are really dense. Like, you basically have to essentially use coding to figure out like strategy game style, like blowing things up, but you have to find them first. And you have to compute like different things first, and it's just like super like dense, hard to like understand stuff. Which leads me to the next thing that I really like about this. Each and every one of these 150 titles has a fully scanned original instruction book attached to them that you can look at. Nice. And like zoom in and read. Yeah, and I don't know if you've ever seen an Atari 2600 instruction book, but those things were massive back in the day. Like 27 or more pages of like pure information and like, you know, really cool art and, you know, all this other flavor text and things like that. Like, it's for somebody who's like interested in really getting down into these games, like each one, the manuals are like a really great addition. And plus, of course, since the entire console is emulated, you can use things like the game selector switch, which of course each game will have like different modes that you can set with that switch. And some of those games have like 20 plus modes.
Oh yeah.
And some of them default to two player. So if you're one player, you actually do really have to pay attention to what mode you're setting it on. And that's the thing that always bugged me about real Atari, like playing on a real console, is I never knew what that game selector switch did. In this game, it actually gives you a little summary of what is changing in the game on the top of the screen as you switch.
That is very helpful.
Oh, it's so extremely helpful. So, you know, all in all, I would say that, you know, the people get down on Atari, and I understand. I think that Nintendo is really where a lot of us figured out that games are awesome. But if you are looking to get into Atari from a non-Atari player standpoint, like me, this is a perfect like thing to actually really get in and get your feet wet. Like, there's no, you know, even though there's a lack of ports like Pac-Man or Donkey Kong, the thing is that, Pac-Man was awful on the 2600, and so it was Donkey Kong. You don't need those ports. They're already available. Like, what you get in this collection is a very solid chunk of, like, what made the Atari 2600 great. Plus, you get some arcade games that are super fun. I really love Black Widow. I think that's actually my favorite. And you even get some 5200 games, which, honestly, I have yet to find one I really like, but at least it's there.
So it's a complete package of the good, the bad, and the weird.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, then, $40 on it. What do you think of the collection?
$40, I think. Well, of course, it's available as a physical cartridge, so, you know, that's a fine price to pay for, you know, a game that has a physical counterpart. I'm actually super happy having it downloaded because, you know, this is a great way to be like, you know, oh, check this out, you know, when you're hanging out with people and such, rather than just be like, all right, I'm going to sit down and, you know, beat all these games or that cart's not coming out. but yeah, $39.99. I mean, the sheer bulk of stuff that you get with this game make it worth it. The great museum style presentation of like all the instruction books and like the art, and of course the decorations on the side that look like the sides of the arcade or the box art, if you will, which is, you know, toggleable. Just experiencing this cool old stuff, you know, that's well worth the price of admission, and especially because you're getting three collections that I think originally all cost $20 each.
Yep, they're $20 each.
Yeah, so, I mean, you're saving money on it anyway. And you want it on the Switch because that touchscreen for Breakout, which Breakout is one of my favorite Atari console games, you're going to want that. So,
nice.
Yeah, go ahead and pick this one up. It's well made. And, oh, by the way, there's one of the rarest games on the Atari 2600 is on it, and that's the infamous Sword Quest Waterworld. I think that's like a $1,000 cartridge now.
Holy shit.
Yeah, the Sword Quest, there's like a trilogy of Sword Quest games, and you had to complete each of them to do something else. I don't really know. There's a metagame type thing going with it that it's in the history books, but it's one of those infamous, you know, video game sort of rarity and collector things. Like, they didn't make enough Sword Quest Waterworlds or something, so the carts that exist are one of those, like, you know, obscenely expensive things, and that all three of those games are on this collection. So
nice,
there you go, saving you $1,000 right there.
Sounds good for only 40.
Yeah,
good stuff. All right. Next game to talk about is called Double Cross, developed by 13AM Games, published by Graffiti Games. It released January 10th on the Switch and Steam for $19.99. Explore alternate dimensions, fight interdimensional criminals, and solve crimes in this thrilling action platformer. Chris, tell us about it.
All right, so the plot of this game. okay, so your character, I wrote down her name somewhere, actually, because I didn't want to forget it, but I've already forgotten.
You forgot it anyway.
Frig, so bad with names. Anyway, your character, Lady, her last name's Sinclair. I think it's Zarna Sinclair. Now I have to look, because I will, the whole internet will come at us with corrections if we don't. But anyway, so yeah, your main protagonist in this game is
Zara.
Part of the Zara. Okay.
Z-A-H-R-A.
That's the one. So she is part of the Rift, which is a sort of collection. You might say they're kind of like the Time Cops, except that what they specifically deal with is parallel universes, specifically Earth, it seems like. They always frame things in talking about alternate Earths. So maybe they're only in control of the one planet. I suppose maybe at some point in the game you find out otherwise. But basically, so they've figured out interdimensional travel, and so, you know, people that travel from one dimension to another can screw up the other dimension, so the Rift goes in and tries to apprehend them or, you know, stop whatever damage that they're trying to cause. For instance, that is actually used in this game, a giant tentacle monster with a whole lot of eyes and a whole lot of, you know, teeth and mouths and just this giant, you know, thing wound up from its dimension into the human dimension, where humans actually happen to perfectly resemble the food that they eat on his original dimension. So, of course, he's apprehended peacefully and is very apologetic for the misunderstanding. But, you know, there was confusion on all sides, let's just say. So that's the kind of thing that the Rift does. So they have some kind of MacGuffin that gets stolen by a bad guy, and the bad guy wears a mask, so nobody knows who it is, but they assume that it's somebody that works on that ship, one of the personnel, because, you know, it's somebody that had access to things other people don't have access to. And so you are sent by your boss to travel to these different worlds and dimensions and, you know, find clues. You collect clues and evidence in order to make a case and then actually apprehend people. So you actually have to follow some protocol here. It's not just running around punching everything until, you know, until you punch the right thing and that ends up being the thing that solves the case, except that that's actually what it is in practice.
Nice.
It's just framed like an investigation. So the actual like, you know, side-scrolling playing of the game reminded me a lot of a kind of a cross between Mega Man and Metroid, which sounds like the most badass thing ever, except that your character actually usually uses her fists. You have a weak punch and a strong punch, and you kind of chain together combos and stuff. And enemies drop power-up things that, as your stuff powers up, it allows you to throw the occasional fireball, heal yourself, make a small explosion, and, you know, such and so on and so forth. And, you know, the game's all about figuring out what of those is the best to use in a situation. The other, so, you know, it's running and jumping and, you know, wall jumping, of course. And on top of that, you actually have a tractor beam, that a localized tractor beam that allows you to, so when you jump and you push the shoulder button, it will slow down time into like kind of a bullet time thing. And then you can aim your reticule at a glowy thing, and then a glowy thing comes out of your arm, which attaches to that glowing thing and then swings you around in the whatever opposite direction that you've, you know, that you've thrown it at. So it's very much like a grapple beam type of situation there. And there's also a temporary shield move that you can use to get past like laser beams and you know, enemies and stuff like that. So lots of cool little action things to learn. The game has a very robust tutorial. as your masked creepy bad guy is stealing the thing, then that actually acts as the tutorial. And nice. Yeah, as you're sort of learning how to fight by punching out these little tiny dinosaur men who look like they were drawn by Family Guy. or drawn for Family Guy. For some reason, it's just those creatures and nothing else in the game, but those things look like they came from Family Guy. Anyways, so the thing is about this game is that so you go and you choose from three planets initially, and each planet has a different stage that you can select, and it just tells you with star ratings how difficult the stage is, and that kind of guides you as to how you should proceed. But you can actually choose any of the levels from any of the three planets until you get to like an unlockable area. So that's about 12 stages that you can choose from just right at the beginning of the game, and that's only for the first like case. So it seems like the game expands to even more planets. So there's a lot of stuff to explore. And then, of course, in each planet, there are collectibles that you only get to keep if you beat the level. And they're cleverly named Upgradium because they're used to upgrade your character in different... Get it?
See
get
what
it?
They did there.
They did a lot of things in this game, actually. There's a lot of... The overall tone of the game is kind of light. I would say it's definitely not like a super dark, you know, pathos ridden sort of adventure. It's lighthearted. The characters are bright and vibrant and cartoony, and a lot of them get along pretty well. The scientist who you meet towards the beginning of the game is named Sam Squatch, and
God.
Yeah, and he looks like you would expect him to. That is to say, he looks like the Ain't It Cool News guy, whatever his name is. I forgot his name. But that guy who, you know, just basically a hairy giant nerd. Nice. Oh, Harry Knowles. Harry Knowles is his name. I was saying hairy giant nerd, and I was like, oh yeah, Harry Knowles. That's the one. But yeah, and then like there's a planet which is called the Thunderdrome, or no, Thunderdome, I think it is. And it's a planet, a version of Earth where the robots have taken over, and they decided to turn the Earth fun, like for robots, but in a way that like is like the plants are all holograms and things like that. And I noticed that area made like several anime references. Like there's a reference to Akira and there's a reference to Nausicaa. And so I was like, oh, okay. So there's all kinds of little things to notice in this game. One thing I did notice while I was playing through, by the way, is that the game is super written. That is to say, there is so much text and dialogue. It acts like an RPG almost in that sense, because you can go through and talk to people and you have to ask them about certain, you know, certain objects that you pick up that, you know, aid in your investigation. And of course, your menu has all kinds of descriptors and like lines of text that it adds to every character's profile. you know, because you're basically doing detective work on top, you know, even though it's disguised as a cool action game. But yeah, so, you know, it's got lots of information, lots of little jokes, and, you know, kind of a lot of personality. The action's really tight. Frame rate kind of, you know, slags a little bit, you know, once the screen gets really busy. But I've noticed that that's kind of the case in a lot of these indie Switch games, is that, you know, they're not using the top of the end, top of the line motor engines or whatever. But I mean, nothing, none of it got in the way. It was just something I noticed. And then, you know, there's a whole wealth of levels. I really like the art style. It's very much like, looks like it's been drawn in ink. Even though it's clearly, you know, 3D, it's got some 3D stuff that happens, but it all looks like, you know, somebody's like comic book essentially. And, you know, soundtrack's good. Had a lot of fun with the levels and things like that. Really liked exploring all the different planets. You know, there's a Gootopia where you get to have fun with different kinds of gelatin. Like, the gelatin serves as a platform, like, from underneath. So you actually make it fall on yourself so that you can swim up into the next area.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, kind of cool stuff like that. And I really dug, like, a lot of the ways that there's a lot of care that went into the level design in this game. And so for that reason, I think it actually kind of stands above some other platformers. And it's nice that it's not randomly generated for once. Well, there's actually a lot of thought that went into the levels, and I like that now.
Which is good. It's good to see a game with hand-designed levels instead of just random generation.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, random generation is all right, but it doesn't stick with you.
Yeah.
Well, oh, and because I think this is the developer of Runbo, right?
Yes.
Okay. It brings back the thing that I loved in Runbo, and that is the option of fun level in the options menu. And it just does nothing. You can select it on, like, very fun or ah or speed run or, you know, all kinds of little options to scroll through. And, oh, there's a no items one, but there aren't any items in the game. So I love that touch. And as soon as I saw that, and the fact that there's also a character from Runbo that's like hidden on a shelf, like in the background.
Nice.
But just enough where I noticed it. I was like, okay, this is excellent from these guys.
Well, then $20 on this one. What do you think of it?
Well, $20. I mean, that's that magical price point in which I'm like, where I usually will be like, well, maybe I'll wait for a physical release, because you know, one of those limited run spinoffs or, you know, super rare games or something are gonna put it out there or whatever. But I mean, no, this is definitely worth a download. Lots and lots of effort went into this. It seems to be a game that is, you know, pretty vast, very meaty, and the action is very satisfying. It's nice to play, and you know, it won't murder you to death with a bunch of randomness and then make you start the whole thing over. It's a nice little adventure, and I really appreciate the amount of effort that went into the details on this one. So no real flaws to speak of, just, you know, it's about as good as indie games get.
Awesome. Sounds good.
Yeah.
One final game for you to talk about is called Hopico, developed by Laserdog, published by Merge Games. It released January 10th on the Switch for $9.99. Hopico is an intense speedrun platformer where you get to save gaming. Jump from platform to platform, avoiding death, exploiting shortcuts, and ripping through hundreds of handcrafted levels, each one dropped into a 5-stage mini run designed to break your mind. Chris, tell us about it.
Hopico, yeah. So, is this one a Switch exclusive?
No, we covered it previously on Xbox, and I believe it's on PlayStation as well, I would presume. Okay.
I'm interested in that because, yeah, the system that they, you know, they talk about, basically the setup to it is that the Hopicos are the little sprites that cause gaming to happen, I suppose, one of those kind of deals. And they're beset upon an angry floating eye that is the virus. And like an episode of Superhuman Samurai Cyber Squad, viruses can apparently just do whatever they want. And, you know, I suppose this virus affects old Nintendo consoles because the system very clearly that is being infected looks like an NES. I didn't know if it was that way on the other platforms as well, but it definitely is in this one.
Oh, I can't remember what they looked. I'm sure they did.
I'm just one to notice these sort of things. But yeah, so you basically, you play as a little spinning superhero. I don't really know if he's got a name or a rank or anything like that. But, you know, the virus has kidnapped these things, and then you have to basically, you know, fling your body into that eye across, they say hundreds of stages. I actually thought there were less than that. So I guess there's a whole bunch.
Yeah, there's a shitload of stages.
Okay, that's awesome. Well, they do go by very, very quickly. And in fact, the game gives you a bonus check mark and, you know, a sort of completion nod if you are able to beat the stages fast enough. So clearly speedrunning is an aspect of this game. So yeah, you basically start a run of levels. There's five each. So when you choose a level, it basically, you know, puts you somewhere, and then you aim yourself with the stick. It by default is the right stick, and I was like, I can't stand this, so I moved it to the left stick. And then I noticed I could also use the A button sometimes. I guess it's when you launch yourself into one of those things, kind of like a barrel in Donkey Kong Country, mm-hmm. where, you know, you push the button at the right time and then it, you know, sort of sails you forward. And basically that's kind of how it is. The whole thing plays like, because you're flinging yourself basically from platform to platform. You don't actually move from left to right. So it is kind of like an extended version of that, you know, Donkey Kong barrel mechanic from Donkey Kong Country, but much more stylized to be like 8-bit and cool and tiny, of course, because what speedrunning indie game doesn't feature tiny sprites? But yeah, you fling yourself at the eye and then you move on to the next stage. If at any point you hit anything that is not that eye or a safe platform, you have to start all five stages over until you can beat all of them. And interspersed throughout these stages are hidden Game Boys, which, again, I guess they look enough not like Game Boys to pass in other consoles, but you're very clearly saving Game Boys. And then there's other things.
It's possible they made them more Nintendo-fied for the Nintendo release. That's very possible.
Yeah, I mean, that would be awesome if they did, because it very much made me think of, like, oh, this is very meta. It's Nintendo playing Nintendo. Like, you have to save Nintendo from a virus that got into an NES somehow through hacking. Hacking. It's never just hacking. You hack your life. You hack a computer.
Hacksaws.
I think that's, yeah, hacksaws. That's how it goes.
Anyway.
Yes, anyway.
We get off topic so easily.
Yeah, yeah. So I want to compliment this game's amazing and varied and, you know, strong soundtrack, but apparently all of the soundtrack has to be unlocked except for one song. That one song, though, is incredible, and I'm going to actually try and find a place to purchase it, because holy crap. It's really deep, thunderous, chiptune-y type Game Boy stuff, which I always hesitate to call video game music that exists in video games chiptune, because chiptune to me strongly implies that it's something that is not in a video game. It is an original composition using video game software and hardware. So when a game says it has a chiptune soundtrack, I'm like, you mean it has a Game Boy soundtrack?
Well, it was a soundtrack composed entirely on a Game Boy. So.
Yes, but still.
Yeah.
Well, that's what this game has, and it's incredible. It's bassy and thunderous, and man, you really got to try this game with, like, nice headphones or on a big screen TV with a nice speaker, because it really racks up the intensity and makes this game, like, a whole lot better. But yeah, it only, like, it has a music player at the bottom of the screen with arrows that indicate that you should be able to choose another track. But I think while you're working through the beginning set of levels that that's the only track available, and then you unlock other tracks later on. That's at least what I'm assuming, because I didn't get far enough to unlock other tracks.
Are you that bad?
No, I played for dozens of levels. I think you know, because there's like this big collection of like levels, and each one of those is five levels, and I haven't gotten through that yet, but that's at least 120 levels, I think, just on its face. So, you know, I'm working on it.
Getting there.
Yeah, I'm getting there. Having a good time doing it. The game's really nice and fast. It does not lag at all. It has great little screen flashy effects, like zoom in effects and like cool, like, you know, slow motion, badass action sequences. And I mean, for the fact that these are very, very basic characters made of like, you know, basically 2D abstraction, it really does a great job of making the whole thing look like a cool action film. The only thing I could say to compare it to would be Broforce. Broforce is the most simplistic, minimalist graphics, and yet it conveys perfectly an action film. That's kind of how this game is, only without the big blocks of digitized blood or anything. This game is very much a safe game for all ages. In fact, that's all the games I've been playing to this week.
Very true.
Yeah. But yeah, no, I quite like this one. It's, like I said, nice and fast. It looks nice. Soundtrack is stellar on this one. I'm very much looking forward to hearing the rest of it.
Well, then $10 on Hopico. What do you think?
Yeah, $10, definitely worth it if you enjoy the kind of fast paced stuff that, you know, this game provides. There's no exploration. It's just stage by stage, you know,
platforming skills.
And I mean, there's a couple of stages that where you can actually just push the A button and launch yourself to the end and beat it in less than a second. Or you can sit there and think about it. Like, there are some stages that clearly have shortcuts in mind. So it's really fun to come to go through a stage and then try and figure out how to do that stage as fast as possible. So I really like when a game encourages you to actually think like a speedrunner. So that's a good little bonus. So yeah, challenge freaks, get on this one. It's nice and
challenging.
Challenging. I was gonna say a good opportunity, but I was like opportunistical. I was trying to come up with a complex word in my head and I failed.
It's okay. You still do better than I do.
Aw, thanks.
Yay. Chris, it is always a pleasure having you on. I missed you while we were gone.
Aw, I miss you too.
Aw, do you have any final words?
Stuff.
All right, moving on. We got Tim Ekibis joining us. Tim, how are you doing? How was your MAGFest? Hey,
good. I just told you this. No, no, MAGFest was great. I hosted some very successful panels and some successful panels, I guess I'd say. You know, I host four panels. Two of them are smaller, but they were fine and fun and enjoyable. And I mean, I guess one of them featured the return of X-Strike Studios, so that's kind of a big deal.
Do tell.
I don't know, something about making videos. There'll be a lot more to say about it, hopefully this time next year, but maybe even in the next few weeks.
Is that a tease?
Kind of. I mean, it's just like we showed one of the videos we've been working on. I mean, the way I put it in the panel is that like the past, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, whenever it was, X-Strike Studios was basically the arc from the beginning of Transformers crashing into the mountain, and the last year was Teletran 1 trying to put all the shit back together. So, we don't got a lot to show for it yet, but hopefully soon. And then, you know, after that, I had my larger panels of Name That Tune and Video Game Improv, which... Pack a Room. Apparently Name That Tune is now my biggest panel. Apparently that has overtaken Improv.
Really?
Yeah.
Because Improv was fucking packed.
Yeah, apparently, according to Brett, who was in the back of Name That Tune, he said he thinks it was even a little more packed for Name That Tune than Improv.
Wow.
And I think it's because people sit a bit closer together at Name That Tune. So, I don't know, but yeah, it's crazy. If you can, yeah. If you go back to like MAGFest 3, where I was just like taking volunteer contestants from the audience, and now I have like 200 people signing up, so things change.
That is insane.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, they need to get some bigger panel rooms. They keep messing with their panel room sizes, and I get it, but also they could use some bigger panel rooms over there for some stuff. Just can't contain me.
Yeah, it's insane, man. MAGFest is beyond what I ever thought it would be. It is crazy.
Yeah, there's more people coming to Name That Tune than went to MAGFest 2, which was the first one I went to, and MAGFest 3, for that matter, I think. Maybe even MAGFest 4. There's more people in that room for my one event than there was at that entire convention.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy to just go to single panels and be like, yeah, this is bigger than MAGFest was.
Yeah. There's like almost more people jamming out to a random DJ in the hallway at 1 a.m. than there was at the first MAGFest. If we're being real, like that one, the one DJ station that's on like the ground floor coming in from the Gaylord gets fucking hype in the middle of the night for some reason.
It does.
It's cool.
It's pretty crazy. I like it.
Yeah.
I think I was walking through there and Miley Cyrus's Party in the USA came on. I'm just like, fuck it. I'm singing along. Everyone else is. Put my hands up to play my song.
Might as well.
Yeah, might as well.
Might as well.
Anyway, so, Vigigames, you had some fun stuff to play while we were away.
Oh, man, aren't you presumptuous? Yeah, no, I hot and heavy getting back into reviews just a week after MAGFest. Time to get back on the old grind. Switch games certainly didn't stop coming out while we were away.
They never do.
And there was something like 30 some of them last week, something ridiculous like that. It's just like... Yeah. And the new Super Mario Brothers U port came out, so it's not like there's a big release there, right? The first week of the year, really. It's boom.
There's too much shit coming out. It's January and there's too much shit coming out.
Yeah. Oh well.
Can't wait for February, because February is going to be batshit crazy too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh man. So should we start?
We should start. Let's do it.
Cool. You got two games to talk about. The first one is called The Shrouded Isle, developed and published by Kit Fox Games. It released January 17th on the Switch for $14.99. Who will you sacrifice, Your Excellency? Sinners in this isolated village try to hide their dark secrets, but heretics must be purged for your salvation. Prepare for the awakening of your hungry god. Tim, it sounds cute and cuddly. Tell me about it.
Yeah, it's warm and fuzzy and a big hug. You should definitely let children play it. The Shrouded Isle, this game came out like a couple years ago, like 2017, summer 2017 on other consoles. The thing that was most striking about me when it came out was the visual design of this game, which in kind of the screenshots they show you has this kind of green tint, which calls to mind the original Game Boy. As it turns out, there's a bunch of different like color palettes you can use to color the game. So it's not just that, but it is a very simple, like, you know, pretty low number of colors involved in the game's graphics, no matter what. So it has a very stark style, no matter what you pick. But I would recommend going into the options and kind of looking through them before you start, because I'd already played a lot of it before I poked my head in there. I was like, oh, I could have been looking at a slightly different color this whole time. Well, not even slightly, extremely different, but, you know, whatever. That's not the point. This is a sort of a management, if I'm really being reductive, like a plate spinning simulation when it really boils down to it. You are the, like, spiritual advisor on this isolated island. It's not kind of unclear how many people are living there. It seems you kind of have five ruling houses, which... have a few people, like 4 to 8 or 9 people in each house, who are lording over the general populace and helping you to enforce discipline and ignorance and fervor and penitence and obedience. So you are kind of juggling those five things, trying to keep the people in line, but you also have to keep in line your five fucking selfish bitchy houses in order. I mean, like, the setup is that you've been on this island or there was, like, the prophecy says that in 500 years your good lord Chernabog is going to return, and, you know, good, great, horrible things are going to happen. But that's what you're going for, and these are the last 5 years. So y'all have been doing this for 495 years, and these houses are still bitchy about who gets sacrificed and da-da-da-da-da-da. You know, you think we could just hold it together for, you know, another 5 years to get to the whole Chernabog thing. We know the routine. Yes, people are going to have to get sacrificed. You don't have to be so butthurt about it. It's nothing personal. Sometimes it's something personal, though.
Just get your shit together, people.
Seriously. So it plays out over the course of 5 years, with each year broken down into 4 seasons. Each season, you are picking an advisor, a spiritual advisor from each house to help you exact your will upon the people. And the way things kind of shake out is... each advisor will help one of the stats. Well, each house, you know, will help one of the stats inherently, but each advisor you potentially pick will help or hinder you, will help and hinder you in some special way. So, you know, you can get someone from the House of Discipline. Sounds fun. The House of Discipline, and they might help your ignorance, but they might hurt your fervor at the same time. So they're raising like two things and they're lowering another thing. And when you pick them to help you exact your plans month to month, you're making that house happy, but you're making the other houses unhappy. You can pick one to three advisors to help you each month. But it will kind of, like, if you pick one person, they will have a much greater effect on the things that they affect. But if you pick three, then each one will have a smaller effect on the things they affect. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's this constantly, you're trying to make sure that you have your kind of your discipline, fervor, penitence, etc., that those are in line, that those are meeting certain levels to keep the population in line. But you also have to keep each house happy, so they don't fall into open rebellion. So you can lose the game if, usually it gives you like a season to right your wrong. So if there's a house that is outright rebellious, you have a season to make them happy. If one of your five other stats falls below a certain line, you have a season to pull that sucker back up. But if you don't, that's a fail state. You get a bad ending, and you lose and you go back, to the beginning. So there is seven different endings or six different endings, six or seven different endings, depending on what you do or how you might gloriously fail, I guess I should say.
Good way to put it.
Well, there's one for each stat. Then there's one for, I think, seems like I didn't get all of them, because I didn't fail. Well, because I failed discipline multiple times, which I guess I got a problem. I guess I need to go to the house of discipline. And then, yeah, there's one for a house rebelling. So, yeah, the trick is that, well, one of the tricks is that at the end of each season, you got to sacrifice somebody, and you're sacrificing one of your advisors. And when you sacrifice somebody, it pisses off the house that they're from. This can be mitigated, because as you are choosing your advisor, and then as they are working for you, you have the opportunity to question their various virtues and vices to find out kind of what they're good at, like what are they actually affecting point-wise. And what you really want to do is try to figure out who the biggest sinners on the island are, like people that are perverts or artists or morbid. Was one of them, because if you find out one of these fuckers, you get a much smaller penalty when you sacrifice them. And usually Chernabog gets in your ear in your dreams and is like, yo, you need to find me the swindler and sacrifice them. It'll make me happy. I will be greatly pleased. I'm like, okay, cool. So it's just kind of trying to manage all this stuff. They also have, after a few seasons, they open up this tower where you can send people to purify them, because sometimes they will get diseased with some kind of madness or something of that nature, so you can send them there to purify them. You can send them there just to put them under examination to learn more about particular characters if you want to. There's only three cells in the tower, so that's another thing you got to manage, because sometimes you'll have people that are freaking out throughout all the main houses. Trying to sacrifice someone that has one of those ailments will just piss off the house, because they're like, no, you could send them and purify them. If you stick a hermit in the tower, they don't want to leave. So there's a lot to consider, and it's just like, it's a big juggling act to figure out like just how to keep this sucker on the rails for 20 seasons. So Chernabog can come back and everybody's happy. Right. And it's fun.
Yay.
This whole game. Yeah, no, it is a fun thing to do I think the theme of the game goes a long way to making it interesting. And just kind of managing all these meters. There is random events that will pop up, sometimes just during the season, sometimes between seasons. You know, you'll get like a letter at your house. You know, some bickering between the families or some problem that's come up, and you have different decisions to make, which will affect different things. The kind of the character traits are randomized every time, so it's never like the same person that's going to be the coward or whatever that you need to suss out. So there is replayability there, the seven different endings. It is, what I will say is a bummer is that I didn't get every ending, but I did finish the 5 years and get the big ending there, and I was kind of hoping that like maybe some game modifiers might unlock that I could use for future playthroughs, you know, to encourage some replayability. some of like the month to month writing in it, describing your advisor's actions, there's only so much of it. I feel like at a certain point, I was just kind of like not even reading it at all and just looking at the numbers. Though there seems to be a decent number of like the random events. Those, I don't think I saw too many repeats of those. One problem, that is, I would guess a little bit unique to the Switch is like, man, that text is a little hard to read sometimes. Like some of that text is very, very small. And this is when you're in both portable mode and playing on the big screen. I haven't played the other version, so I don't know how they compare. But that is kind of a bother. If you have problem reading very small text, this you might have to pass on this game. And me just playing it for like just when I got home today, I was like, man, I want to do one more run because I really want to see if I can finish it before the review. So I was playing it for a couple hours and like, man, are my eyes getting strained that I've just been playing it for this long? So that is unfortunate. I don't know if there's anything they could do to patch that just to make some of the text a bit bigger, but that would be lovely and an absolute relief, in trying to play and enjoy this game, which is playable and very enjoyable.
Which is very good to hear.
Yeah, it is very good to hear.
Well, then $15 on it. What do you think of it?
Yeah, I think it's a buy it. It's interesting enough. It's fun to play. I mean, a run of the game, if it goes well, is going to take a couple hours, you know, sometimes a lot less than that if things go bad very quickly and you put someone out there to invoke some discipline and they fuck up all the time and you just lose right off the bat. Not that I'm bitter.
Not at all.
Yeah, so yeah, it's not, you're going to get, probably at least 4 or 5 hours on it if you don't somehow ace it the first time, which my first playthrough, I did make it almost to like 3.5 years in, and I was like, man, am I going to pull this off the first time? No, the wheels fell off the creep train right there towards the end. I'm just like, yeah, I can't, I'm not, it's all just too many plays to try to keep up, but. On my victorious run, it's just like all those 5 stats weren't even an issue. It was just a matter of keeping all those idiots happy.
And happy idiots are good idiots.
Happy idiots are good idiots, and they get you to the end so your good Lord Chernabog can come back and destroy the world.
Hooray.
Or whatever. Who knows? Yeah, hooray. Cool. I liked it.
Cool. Good to hear.
Yeah.
All right, well, you got one other game to talk about. That is called Samsara Deluxe, developed and published by Marker Limited, released January 10th on the Switch for $9.99. Help Z escape Samsara. Drop blocks of different shapes and properties into a realm of two mirrored dimensions in this beautiful reflective puzzle game with a twist. New first-to-Switch content with an additional 24 levels, new block type, and one new realm. What are you giggling about?
I guess we'll get to it.
Well, then let's hear it.
All right. Oh, right now? I mean, it'll make more sense later in the review.
Okay, well then start the review.
All right, let's start the review.
Tell us about Samsara Deluxe.
Samsara Deluxe DX for Switch. This is a puzzle game where the general idea is you have a character, or eventually characters, because the game takes place, I want to say just on like a pond. There's different backgrounds. There's a little more to it than that. But basically, you will see there will be objects and kind of obstacles like on the top half of the screen, and then the bottom half is that reflected downwards, not always exactly and precisely. You take one look at the game, you're like, oh, okay, I get it. Like things are slightly different in the bottom half than they might be in the top half. But eventually, you have your normal dude, and then you have a shadow version of him or her. I think it's him. And the object is. So they just stay stationary and you get these blocks, right? And you kind of have to make a path so they can get to the exit. So you're, you know, filling in holes, putting in staircases, and just arranging these blocks so that both characters will make it to the exit when you press the go button, right? And these guys are super fragile and not very smart because you press go and they're just going to go straight in that direction unless they hit a wall, and then they're going to turn around and go back the other way. If they fall any amount of distance, they will die instantly. So you got to take some care with them. They're not going to climb up things. They're not going to gently climb down things. They're not going to turn around when they get to the edge of a pit. You have to determine their exact path. And so kind of where things get funky and puzzly is the fact that as you're placing these blocks, they also, like, if you put them on the bottom half of the screen, they will reflect on the top half of the screen. So you're kind of placing one block twice, is the idea. So it's you getting creative with, like, okay, I need to position this block just so on the bottom, and maybe on the bottom, it's resting upwards because it goes up. Gravity goes up. Gravity pulls to the center of the screen. It's resting on a block that's on the bottom that doesn't exist on the top. So on the top, that block or staircase you just placed might fall an extra space on the top. So you might want that to happen, or you might not.
And, it's like it's a puzzle game.
It's like it's a puzzle game. And they give you three different kinds of there's basically there's some different shapes. There's, you know, like your standard block, there's some different size and length staircases, but they come with three different properties. There's like a basic wooden one, and that you just place and it falls whatever on both sides. There's a concrete one where if you place that on the bottom and it's resting on a block, it will not fall on the top screen. So okay, it might just float in midair on the top half of the screen. And then there's like a golden one where which gets really weird, because when it falls on the, when it gets, it doesn't fall down on the top half. Basically, it falls up for whatever reason. Magic gravity.
Hooray.
So that's basically, that's what you're working with and try to arrange. There is one other, that's right. The other mechanic little thing is they have these vines that when your character runs over them or runs through them, they will either solidify or desolidify. So if you run over top of it, it'll desolidify. And if you run through it, it will resolidify. And this can have relevance for making blocks fall after you run over them, so that they fall on the other screen for the other character, and then they can move forward. There's some stages have little teleporters, like portals, literal portals. They're orange and blue that will pop you from one side, the top half, to the bottom half.
It's all just a novel idea.
Yeah, it's all just things to confuse you and make you have to sit there and really think and stare to figure out how you're going to get these guys from one point to the other. Kind of the problem is, and the reason I was laughing at that they added 24 levels to this game is up until, so the way the game is broken down into stage or worlds of eight, I guess I should say. So each hub kind of has eight levels to it, right? So that means that they added the last three levels are the new ones that they added on. And it's funny because to me, the game didn't start really getting interesting until about world nine. So that's where the game ended before. Like, that's just when it started to get interesting. up till that point, like the first, you know, eight of 12 worlds, I just thought were like super simple. And kind of a bit tedious to get through because, like, especially early on, I'd be in a level and you only have so many pieces to work with early on and in general. They give you, on each stage, you have exactly the number of pieces you need in order to solve it and get your character through. So it didn't feel like there was a lot of ways to go wrong early on and in a lot of stages. And I'm not saying, like, every stage between World 1 and World 8 was a total cakewalk. There was a couple that made me think a bit. But for the most part, it was just like, okay, well, I have these three pieces and there's only so many ways that they could go here. I'm done. And so you'd go and I'd finish the stage. And then every time you finish a stage, it pops you back out and there's like animations to pop you back out to the hub. And then you select this next stage and there's animations to pop you back in. I really super wish they just moved you on to the next level. And then if you wanted to pop back out to the hub, the main menu, whatever.
That was just, like, one of my gripes when we first reviewed the game on Xbox.
Oh,
was that I wish you could just move from level to level.
Yeah, it drove me nuts. It was like early on, I was just finishing things so fast and then just like, back in, back out. It kind of, you know, it broke the flow of the puzzling. But yeah, it wasn't terribly satisfying for me for a lot of my play. It wasn't until like World 9, which I guess would have been the last level of the previous version of the game, where I'm like, oh, this is like things started to get interesting here.
I don't know if the new levels are at the end or if they're sprinkled throughout. So it's possible.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm not sure how they handled the new levels.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know either. Questioning. well, then either they added a bunch of fluff or they added a bunch of good stuff till the end of it. I don't know which. But either way, it's okay. Like it's a pretty solid puzzle game. It's got a decently cool mechanic. The art I didn't think was especially like it, just the style didn't grab me. Like it's fine, you know? But it didn't really seem to have much of a story going on to connect things. There was like a few, little cutscenes between levels, but it was just kind of like, okay, I went through this portal.
Hello? Uh-oh. I lost you.
It's weird. Just like Skype just it wasn't even like it crashed. It just went away. It was just
bye.
Going, and then it wasn't. So I don't know what caused that at all.
Hooray.
Still recording. What was the last thing?
Still recording.
Where am I?
You went into a portal, something like that.
I went into a portal and I popped back out. I was just saying that like there didn't seem to be a lot of like story to kind of explain what was going on or connect things. Usually the levels worked out in that they kind of use the same art assets for two worlds in a row. Just the second one would be a bit darker, thematically. As far as puzzle games go, like it's okay. Like it's solid, but I didn't think it to be particularly exceptional. Especially since the last time I was on the show, I was reviewing the Gardens Between, which I thought was great and was super satisfying, and I liked the story and all the art and stuff it did. And then, you know, this compared to that, I was just kind of like, it's fine. It's competent, but not exceptional.
Well, then $10 on it, what do you say?
I think it's a try it. It's not like a must-play puzzle game. $10 is not a bad price for it at all. If you are looking for something to tickle your puzzle fancy on the Switch and you haven't already played Semblance, remember that game from last July, then, you know, this one might be something, worth checking out.
Cool. Sounds good. Yeah. I enjoyed it when it was on Xbox. It doesn't seem like it tickled your fancy as much as it tickled ours, but
yeah,
you know, different strokes, different folks and stuff like that.
Like I said, it's not bad. I'm just like,
just not world changing.
Can't give it the full hearty recommendation.
Makes sense. Tim, it is always good having you on chatting about this kind of stuff. I know you're going to be back on soon.
Oh, yeah.
Until then,
there's a rumble coming up.
A rumble cast coming soon.
Yeah, and more reviews. I'm already cracking on the next review.
You were balls deep in reviews.
Whew, that's great. I was, like, dying kind of during Christmas. Not dying. I mean, I was playing other games on my Switch, but I'm, like, coming back from Magfest, I'm like, I'm fucking ready. I'm ready. Let me at him. All right.
Gonna break your total for 2018.
Yeah, we'll see. Hopefully, off to a good start.
Indeed. Well, Tim, right. Always good having you on. Do you have any final words before we move on?
I do not. Sorry, I got nothing.
Aww, nothing.
I got no discipline. didn't stick to it.
All right, and we got one final game to talk about tonight. And joining us for this one, Royal Sefton. How are you doing? How was your New Year?
Ooh, I'm blast. New Year was good.
Yeah, you're wrapping things up. You excited?
Yeah, I feel honored.
You should. I picked you to go last because you were last on the list of games being reviewed. So. It's a privilege, an honor and a privilege. How was your New Year?
No, it was good, man. Thank you. I actually survived long enough to ring in the new year. I stayed up until somewhere around like 1:30, 2 o'clock, which that's like 4 hours past my pumpkin hour now. So I was surprised. I surprised myself. How about yours?
It was uneventful. It was just preparing for MAGFest, which I'm still trying to recover from. I don't know if I'm going to... I think I'm getting too old to recover fully anymore, so I'm just going to be half dead every year.
Yeah, MAGFest starts happening to you soon, right?
Oh, God. It's only a year away.
Mm-hmm. Better start prepping.
Counting down the days.
Mm-hmm.
Good stuff. Anyway, you got a game to talk about. We should probably talk about it, huh?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, let's do that.
Final game to talk about tonight is called Legendary 11, developed and published by Eclipse Games. It released January 4th on Xbox One for $14.99. Legendary 11 is an epic arcade football game inspired by the golden age of football spanning the 70s to the 90s. A fresh approach to the beautiful game with fluid gameplay and unique mechanics like morale, super shots, or stickers to boost your stats. Choose from 36 teams from the glorious haircuts, mustaches, and legends in short shorts. Lead them to glory and win the World Cup. We should probably point out it says football, but for us filthy Americans, it's soccer.
Yeah. Not football American.
Football. Gotta make that clear that it is a soccer game and not American football.
That is correct. It certainly is. Yes, and good to mention the hairdos. I remember seeing mostly afros as I played this.
36 teams full of glorious haircuts, mustaches, yes, and legends in short shorts. I stumbled over that line a little bit. So,
who wear short shorts? They wear short shorts.
I do, yeah, too.
Oh, yeah. I wow.
You're welcome.
My train of thought just hit the penny on the tracks and went flying. All right.
Well, okay, I know Chris Taylor checked this one out a couple of weeks ago on the Switch. How does it hold up on Xbox One?
Oh, well, you know, I want to like it. I really do. And I should throw out maybe one or two cautionary statements. One, I don't play a lot of sports ball, real or virtual. And two, I don't really watch a lot of sports ball, real or virtual. So I may not be the target audience here. That's a fair statement. I have to make that concession before I go any further. It's definitely got a good, bright, arcadey feel to it. And when you first fire it up, it's got a really rousing theme music. And you're not starved for choice when it comes to teams or, you know, different cups. They have different continental events, kind of like a World Cup type thing. You have Africa Cup and so on. You definitely have some amount of depth here, depth of choice, picking who you want to play as and who you want to play against. There are also these cards. I didn't have any luck getting any of these new cards to adjust their abilities, the team's abilities as I progressed. So I couldn't really comment on how impactful they were one way or the other. But, you know, just in terms of like platform comparison, etc., I guess I couldn't say, but I would say that, you know, load time's good, game plays fairly well visually, it's decent enough. It's just that there is, I think, there's definitely a few things about it that I found it hard to really get into, really to engage with. And, you know, the thing that when we talk about delivering a game on console and you just download it and you start playing it, it's almost become an expectation that you have some sort of a tutorial or a walkthrough. And there's nothing like that with Legendary 11. And you know, like 20, 30 years ago, you buy a game at the store, either you read the manual or you chuck it out and you start playing, one of the two. If you couldn't figure out how to play the damn game, obviously that's on you because you had the instructions. And to be fair, controllers had fewer buttons, etc. Oh, that's a nice story, Grandpa. You know where I'm going with this. Point is, when you buy and download a game nowadays, usually there's just a little bit of hand-holding necessary to tell you what to do because, you know, your flight deck has 300 buttons on it. I kept fouling people left and right trying to figure out how to just get the ball away from them, so I kept just drop-kicking them until I figured out what the right button was to try to steal.
You know, those motherfuckers down.
I was like, man, are you seeing this, ref? Yeah, I got carded a lot. It was bad. So, yeah, I learned the B button is definitely not intended for taking the ball back unless you're taking it by force, and that is probably going to make the game a little harder. You were not going to be very successful. So I later found out, oh, if I press the X button, I actually can take the ball away from them. And learned that I can use the A button to pass, and I learned I can hold down a trigger and press the A button to do a 1-2 pass. And I I held down the trigger, pressed the A button, and did a pass, and it felt a little faster than the last one. And when I was waiting for another pass to go through, I started tapping the A button, and so I did a pass, and then I just kind of kicked into the middle of the field for the other team to pick up. So it was very easy to fumble or lose sight of what you're doing. I feel like that lack of intuitiveness is only hindered by the fact the game does not come with any kind of tutorial or guidance at all when you're playing. Just some helpers would have, I think, helped the game a lot. You can go into the config and you can look at the buttons. You know, that would have been smart of me to do, I guess, to go back and review, you know, controller config. With PC games, I always end up doing that because inevitably there's something that's funky that I'm going to do wrong. I think that was pretty much the biggest barrier to me getting into Legendary 11 was feeling like I was supposed to know not only how soccer's played, and I got that part. I understand that the rounds are very short, though. I got to comment on that. But I also have to figure out how to use the controller. It's sort of, you know, trial by fire when you're jumping into a game. You don't have that sort of instruction.
Yeah.
That was really my biggest check against the game in my review. I just wish I had a better idea of how to play the game. especially because as I started to experiment, I started doing some really badass kicks. I did this, like, you know, one knee, then off the foot, and then a bicycle kick right into the goal, and it just looked freaking amazing. And I had no idea how I did it ever again. I think I held down a trigger and pressed B. I'm not sure. You know, it was kind of difficult. B is a shot button, but when you don't have the ball, it also has you, like, do a sweep or something. That's what I kept, like, knocking folks over with. So it's just kind of rough and mercurial gameplay because I simply couldn't figure out how to play it, if that makes sense. But there's some other things about it that I kind of got to bring up too. The teams aren't really balanced, which struck me as kind of a strange idea for an arcade game. Maybe they're going for more simulation based on how they played during that era and what the best team was composed of, how you would rank that team at that time in terms of their defense, offense, speed, whatever. But you can actually go through the teams. You can see some are just basically superior to others. The one thing I will say that's kind of neat about that maybe is if you know your teams well enough and you're playing against another player, you would be able to treat it like a handicap system. You pick the lousy team, you know, and you can, you know, allow the less experienced player to pick the more advanced team, the more effective team, I guess. Just kind of seems a little broken. Usually you'd kind of have your trading one off for the other, and they should all be relatively balanced when you're picking teams, I would think.
Yeah, it's kind of like the old NBA Jam and NFL Blitz games where the teams were definitely, you know, they weren't all equal.
Yeah.
So no one wanted to pick like the Milwaukee Bucks or something. You always wanted the Bulls or the Knicks.
Yeah, everybody was on the Bulls when that game was out for sure. So that's a very good point.
Well, it sounds like it's enjoyable, but with a fairly high barrier for entry. Overall, $15 on it. What do you think of it?
I gotta side on try it with that one. It's a pretty firm try it for me. I don't feel like this is an insta-buy kind of game. I feel like if there was maybe a little more player guidance, if maybe there was a little more engagement when you're actually playing, because the camera's very static, it'd be cool if there was something a little more dynamic. Like when I did that really badass kick, for example, it'd been cool if the camera actually panned in and showed me doing it, or some sort of like bullet time effect. You know what I mean? Just kind of jazz it up. There's none of that there, so it feels a little flat for an arcade game in that sense, you know, not as engaging as it could be. If they just kind of turned up some of those other things up to 11, then they would have, I think, an insta-buy here, but it's very much a try it. It's not all bad. I can see this being a lot of fun, and I definitely had a few laughs when I was playing through it and kept fouling the enemy and stuff. I don't know. I enjoyed some parts of it. It was okay.
You just like beating the shit out of other players.
That's pretty much what it comes down to. Yes, I'm more of a fighting game kind of guy.
Nice.
Unfortunately, I can't turn soccer or football into a fighting game. Maybe if it was a rugby simulator. There you go.
All right, next rugby game that comes along, I'll be sure to put a request in for you.
You got it.
<I'll> Oh, Royal, it is always good having you on chatting about this stuff. Quick thanks to everyone who was on the episode doing their reviews. A lot of catch up after the MAGFest break, so we're getting back into the swing of things. It's going to be a learning process. I got to remember how to do this shit.
Was I supposed to agree?
If you want.
No.
I don't remember how to do this show. I took 3 weeks off. I don't know what the fuck I'm doing anymore.
Well, welcome back.
Thank you, Royal. Music.
I don't care what anybody says. You're doing a great job, man.
You are a liar. Music this episode, I'm going to play a couple more tracks from Frank Klepacki and the Tiberian Sons from their MAGFest set, because it was an awesome show and there's more songs to play and I want to play more of them. And if you got a problem with that, I don't give a shit. How about that?
Mm-hmm.
Yay. So, Royal, do you have any final words to end the show? We'll be right back.
Today, we march forward into our future, a stronger people, a divine people, enhanced for the Tiberium world. The time has come to claim this world as our own. The time has come to destroy GDI. One vision, one purpose. Peace through power.
everyone. We'd love to talk to every one of you. Good night.